Extend this morning's meeting by 7 hours. I hope you remembered to bring, I don't know why you're laughing. I hope you remembered to bring lunch and an afternoon snack and dinner and dessert for those of you who prefer that. So let's begin by reading our text. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Heavenly Father, we ask that you would help us this morning. Guide my words, help us to focus on our passage, give us the ability to concentrate and the desire to apply our minds to the detailed theology that Paul has given us. Please give us guidance as we seek to apply this passage as well. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, since Doug told a lie about me, I'll tell a lie about Steve Weisbecker. He asked for a title for my message from Colossians 1, 3 through 8 last month, and I didn't have a title, and so he said, the next time you speak, you better have a title or else. And so I said, okay, I'll come up with a title. And so our title for this morning is Focus on Christ. Christ preeminent may be more intuitive. That's how a lot of Bibles have something to that effect at the heading of our hymn this morning, beginning in verse 15. But as we move to application towards the end of this morning, we'll see that I think focus on Christ is a really good bridge to apply this belief that Christ is preeminent. We've had the opportunity to cover a lot of background information so far in our study in Colossians, and this is very important. I want to touch on a couple of the things that you see in green, the things in blue we've already discussed, and so this should fully set the stage regarding background information, and as we move forward in Colossians, we'll simply be able to refer back to what you've heard over the last several Sundays that we've spent in Colossians, and perhaps we'll go into more detail as we need to in specific areas. So I don't want to go through this slide in detail, but I did just want to put some more specifics to the generalities that we've discussed. Steve Weisbecker began in our introduction with a certain movement in scholarship in the 19th century, and this movement began to question the authenticity of several New Testament books, including Paul's writings. And so you have names of scholars on this PowerPoint that's been emailed, and you can look more into these if you like. F.C. Bauer is a big name here, and you'll see his name associated with Hegelian dialectic. And so how did he come to these conclusions that some of Paul's writings and some of the New Testament writings were so late? And so you have this thesis and antithesis, or antithesis, in the Hegelian dialectic, and that's what gives you the synthesis, or the conclusion. Okay, so you need two forces opposing each other, and that's how you understand the outcome. And so for him, the two forces opposing each other would be Pauline Christianity and then Peter's Christianity. So you have Paul's church and you have Peter's church. Paul's church is the Gentile church. Peter's church is the Jewish church. They're battling it out, and under the common threat of Gnosticism, they decide, hey, we're better in this together. And so at the end of the second century, the church joins as one to fight Gnosticism. And throughout this time, New Testament documents are being produced. And so that's how Bauer came to his conclusions that nobody follows today. So you get to, for example, the Gospel of John. John, to him, doesn't look Pauline or it doesn't look Petrine. And so what do you do with it? Well, if it's not part of the antithesis or it's not part of the thesis, well, then it's the synthesis. And so the Gospel of John had to have been produced late in the second century. Which is interesting because around the 1930s, we find the P52, which is a small copy of the Gospel of John. The early range of dating on that small fragment is 125 AD, which is pretty miraculous that we have copies of the Gospel of John written before the Gospel of John was actually written, which means even if the Gospel of John was late second century, you should pay attention to it because it's clearly miraculous. So that's F.C. Bauer. We also mentioned the Gnostic thesis, advanced by some as early as the 17th century, and that gets more academic development by around the early 19th century as well. That's not sufficiently nuanced. We'll see today that there's an important Jewish aspect to Paul's opponents. And we'll look at one Dead Sea Scroll text in particular. All this stuff is going to become very important in chapter 2. So then we see Jesus as Lord could not happen in a non-Jewish setting. This is Wilhelm Bousset as well as F.C. Bauer. And we already discussed this as well a couple of weeks ago in Colossians. And then we have in the 60s a movement that begins to say not enough focus has been given toward the Jewish aspect of Paul's opponents. And that's going to be very important for us this morning. So what is some of this Jewish background that Paul is dealing with? This is one text from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's the Shabbat Sherot, which is the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the background here, or really in the text itself. You see a lot of brackets and periods, and that's because it's a fragmentary text. Scholars sometimes can reconstruct the text, other times they just have periods. We don't know what was here, something was here. In Jewish mysticism, Ezekiel chapter 1 was a major, major text. A lot of mystical speculation was developed using Ezekiel chapter 1. Secondary was Isaiah 6 that we heard read this morning as well. And in Ezekiel's vision, he sees God on his throne, and that's what you have here, a very similar picture with this throne chariot imagery. And the throne has wheels. You have the ophanim. That's the Hebrew for wheels. I'm not sure why it's not translated in this text. And so the ancient thrones are portrayed as chariots. Remember, chariots is a symbol of power. Okay, and so this is what Ezekiel sees. He sees God on his throne, and there is an attendance, a group of attendees around this throne as well. It may surprise you then to see effectively what Ezekiel saw is multiplied in this Jewish text. Okay, so we move from one throne and one God on the throne to this scene right here, where notice there are multiple gods, Elohim, which is also a generic Hebrew word for divine beings. Multiple divine beings on multiple thrones with multiple sets of attendees. So you take Ezekiel's vision and you multiply it, and that's what we have here. And so if you're only familiar with modern Judaism, which is effectively rabbinic Judaism that's more developed, you may be very surprised to know that this is, in fact, a Jewish text. Some of the ideas from proto-Gnosticism that we see are reflected in modern Jewish mysticism, and I want to cover this because to show you that these movements are still around, and because this gets us in really the mood to understand, I think, Paul's concern. So when you look at modern mysticism, I have basically transferred to this slide some of my notes from monographs that I've read. And as I've gone through these texts for various reasons over the years, I've noted the parity to New Testament theology. And this is actually really alarming. So there are various forms of mysticism I have on the PowerPoint for you. One is mystical union. I won't go into details here, but through a series of rituals, you can become, the mystic becomes a dwelling place for the divine. Okay? But you can already get that in New Testament theology, and I have several texts up for you. One of them was read this morning from Ephesians chapter 2. So then, this Kabbalistic theology parodies the New Testament. The tzaddik, the righteous one, that's a Hebrew word meaning righteous one, and here is a form effectively of necromancy, where you go pray to a dead mystic and then this person intercedes for you. Perhaps he can grant some requests for you. How about praying to the one who was dead and who is alive forevermore? Right. What about the book of Hebrews that says we have a great high priest who forever lives to make intercession for us? So do you see the parody here? New Testament theology is being parodied. There's also the second form of the tzaddik, which is drawing down divine grace. The mystic becomes a repository for the divine influx that flows out of heaven that he then channels to his community. And so this person becomes effectively part of the temple on earth. Once again, how do you replace the temple that was destroyed in AD 70? These are part of the questions that the mystics are trying to answer. And so Matthew 12:6, Jesus says something greater than the temple is here. What's the goal of Kabbalah, of modern Jewish mysticism? You can read that quote if you want, word for word, but the goal is to create a messianic effect by spreading the knowledge of Kabbalah. And so you can see here that they are parroting New Testament theology. They're parroting the Messiah. They're creating their own messianic movement. And so what would you say if you saw an Orthodox Jew who's over 40, because you can't study this if you're less than 40, and you ran into someone like this? What would you want to say, knowing just this little bit of background? You would want to show them that this is a shadow, a distorted shadow of the true substance. And you would want to show them that they're trying to construct a theology because of the theology that they reject, and they're trying to fill that void that's there. And they get this from the Hebrew Scriptures. They know that there's supposed to be something like this that comes, but they reject the Messiah, and so they construct their own theology to fill in that gap. And so you would want to tell them that what you believe is a distraction, okay? And so I think that gets us into the mood for Paul, because Paul here is dealing with a lot of distractions. There's a lot going on in the world of the Colossians. So what is going on? We looked at the Dead Sea Scroll text, and there are other texts in the Dead Sea Scrolls, as well as other Second Temple texts that are distractions. We talked about Jude a couple of months ago. Do you remember that? Jude uses the Jewish traditions to show his readers that appealing to angels is worthless. They can't even help you out. They can't rebuke Satan. So why are you so concerned with them? Paul, in chapter 2 of Colossians, criticizes worshiping angels, and he talks about dreams and visions that these people are having. And apparently there's some pride associated with this. I've had more spiritual experiences than you, and so I'm better. So there are a lot of distractions in the day of the Colossians that Paul is trying to deal with. Now, Lauren mentioned 2 weeks ago that Paul's approach in Colossians is a bit different from, say, 1 Corinthians. So in Colossians, Paul has his opening, his greeting, his prayer, his thanksgiving, and then he goes right into just straight Christology. Why does he do that? He's going to want to show the Colossians who to focus on, and he's going to say this explicitly at the beginning of Colossians chapter 3. But before he tells the Colossians who to focus on, he's got to tell them who Christ is, because there are a lot of supernatural beings around this time that a lot of people are concerned with. And so first he has to set Christ apart. He has to show his readers why Christ is different. And so he does that with this hymn. So can we call this a hymn? I think we can. There's a lot of literature on this passage, more than any passage in the New Testament. So I've tried to sift through it and give you some of the best of it. It's generally agreed that this is a hymn. If we use this rather generic definition of a hymn, it's one that's in an excellent PhD dissertation by a scholar who did his work back in 2004, I think, 2006. He says, a self-contained composition of a relatively short length whose contents are primarily centered on praise of the divine. And so when you read Colossians 1:15 through 20, well, it's certainly self-contained. It's also brief, and it focuses on Christ. So this seems to meet our definition fairly well. Against that, ancient hymns typically have three parts. They have an invocation. We're familiar with this from the Psalms. O Lord, hear my cry. And then the psalm continues. Then we have the second and third part, which are self-explanatory, praise and petition. So it's clear that our text does not have the invocation, nor does it have the petition. And Matthew Gordley notes, the individual I'm quoting here, notes that there are numerous hymns like this in the ancient world that skip the first and third part and go right to the second part. And the reason for that seems to be to emphasize part two, to emphasize the praise of the divine. And so it may be that the Colossians and us can establish from what Paul says and what he does not say exactly what Paul's focus is. And so in skipping the invocation, in skipping the petition, Paul wants to dedicate this hymn to the praise of Christ and to expounding who he is. As we go through this passage this morning, we have several themes, and we already heard one of these themes. We began our remembrance meeting with it this morning, and that is the creation, new creation theme. Okay, so let's go through these, and I won't comment on them now. If they aren't clear to you, they will become clear as we continue this morning. So, first, creation theme. He is the image of the invisible God, recalling Genesis. New creation theme. In him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Second line, creation. He is the firstborn of all creation. New creation. He is also the firstborn from the dead. creation theme. He is before all things, new creation. He is the head of the body, the beginning, so that he himself will come to have first place in everything. Creation theme, line 4, for by him all things were created, both in heavens, in the heavens and on earth, and new creation through him to reconcile all things to himself, whether things on heaven, on earth or things in heaven. Second theme we want to look at is the image of God, recalling, of course, Genesis 1 language, and he is the image of the invisible God that we just read, verse 15, and we could throw Colossians 3:10 in there as well, which we may visit later. And the third and final theme is temple. In him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and we'll see that Paul connects this back to a psalm that talks about the dwelling place of God. So, let's begin then with verse 15. He is the image of the invisible God, and you can argue grammatically that there is something called a nomic present, which is timeless, and so that's why I have timeless in parentheses for you. So is from eternity past, is present, and is for eternity future. And we typically want to think about this in terms of the incarnation, and John 17 is a really good example of this. We spent some time in it last week. In verse 6 of John 17, Jesus says, I made your name known to them, known to his followers. Name referring to the essence, to the character, of course, in biblical theology. It's not just what you're called. And so Jesus manifested the name to his followers. Okay, and so it's entirely correct to think about it in that terms, but notice that in the context here, Paul wants us to focus on creation, the surrounding context. The next verse, for by him all things were created. And so while it's correct to think about the incarnation, we will do so in the second half of the hymn, we want to focus now on creation, on the eternal Son and creation. And so what can we say about this? Something called Christological anthropology, I believe, comes into play here, and that is that we were created in the image of God, according to Genesis chapter 1. Okay, who is the image of God? That's Christ. Notice it doesn't say he is in the image, but he is the image. So if we were created in the image of God, and Christ is the image of God, then that means we're created in the image of Christ, which is why we find in the New Testament that we are to be conformed to his image. That's the new creation language that we're going to encounter. And so we'll see later that image has a revelatory function, and so we typically think of Christ imaging God as, okay, we want to look at God. What does God look like? What is his name? What is his character? What is his essence? We look at Christ. But Christological anthropology also lets us say, okay, if we want to look at humanity, what was humanity supposed to be according to God's design? Where do we look? Look at Christ, because we're created in his image, you see. The image is thoroughly authentic. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 1. The ESV reads a bit different. I'll substitute image where the Greek words coincide to make this clear. Listen to this contrast. For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true image of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every year, make perfect those who draw near. So the image is thoroughly authentic. It's contrasted with the mere appearance or the mere shadow. We could also add Colossians 2:17 in there. It's a different Greek word, but the same concept. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. And so the image is thoroughly authentic. I'll read a quote from a really good dictionary of New Testament theology. It says, the original is always present in the image. In the New Testament, all the emphasis is on the equality of the icon, the image, with the original. So the image is thoroughly authentic. The Son also has a revelatory function, being the image of God. And so think about, he is the image of the invisible God. So he is the image, he makes apparent, he reveals that which is normally imperceptible to the human senses. And so there's a revelatory function there as well. Hebrews 1:1-3, I'll read John 1:18, which says, no one has ever seen God, there's the invisible aspect, the only God who is at the Father's side has made him known. And of course, Hebrews 1 says, I'll just read that, long ago at many times and in many ways God spoke to our fathers, there's the revelation, by the prophets, but in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. So the image also has this revelatory function as well. The image is also connected to glory, and there are numerous texts here. This is a really fascinating study. I'll just kind of read some of these, and since this has been emailed out, you can look at all these verses, which I have up for you as well. So I'll just read 2 Corinthians 4:4. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So there we have that close connection between glory and image, and 2 Corinthians 3:18 as well. And we all with unveiled face, this is going back to some really interesting Exodus background, which we don't have time to look at, beholding the glory of the Lord are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. So there's a close association with image and glory. And of course, image is also connected to ruling. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, man and woman are to take dominion over the earth and to rule over it. So this is also connected with image as well. So, a summary of our observations so far. The Son is the divine archetypal image. The image is thoroughly authentic. Image is connected to glory, and image is connected to ruling as well. And we won't treat these fully, but I do want to bring to your attention a couple of other texts from Romans. We've read that Christ is that the Son is the image of the invisible God. And this is a different word in Greek, and so the ESV translators do well. They don't use image, but they use likeness here. But keep this in mind. The Son is the image of the invisible God. Okay, now let me read Romans 8:3. By sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. So the image of the invisible God came in the likeness of sinful human flesh. Why did he do that? Romans 8:29 says, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. And so the image of the invisible God came in the likeness of sinful human flesh so that we may be conformed to his image. And certainly being conformed to his image, being sanctified, requires a lot of effort on our part, but we owe that to the Son who is the image and who came in the likeness of sinful human flesh. I also like to stress the tenses. A couple of Sundays ago, I talked about salvation. If you asked Paul, are you saved? He would say, well, I have been saved, I'm being saved, and I will be saved. Okay, so here we have this idea of being transformed into the image of Christ. This is also has numerous tenses associated with it. So we have Colossians 3:10, which refers to the new self, which is being, present tense, is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. And then 1 Corinthians 15:49 tells us that we will bear, future tense, the image of the man in heaven. So this is something that occurs over a process as well. So how do we get from firstborn language to son language? And what is this firstborn over all creation? How are we to interpret this? So the bridge, the interpretive bridge, is to look at Genesis chapter 5, which we won't do this morning because of time. But Genesis 5, 1 through 3, uses the same terminology, which connects it back to Genesis chapter 1, 26 through 28. And there, the image and likeness that Adam's son bears is semantically connected back to Genesis 1. And Luke picks up on this, by the way, at the end of his genealogy. So the first genealogy in the Bible starts with God. The last genealogy in the Bible ends with God. So Luke, at the very end of his chapter 3 of his genealogy, calls Adam, what? The son of God. Okay, so Luke is tracking along with this trajectory as well. So for us, firstborn has a temporal sense. If you're first, you're not the second, right? Is the temporal sense what's in view here? And it is by default for the eternal Son who obviously precedes creation, okay? So by default, there is a temporal aspect to this. And it may be in view here. I'm not going to exclude it because Paul is very inclusive with his terminology, as we'll see, right? All of creation. Christ is above all. He's before all. And so Paul is very inclusive. And so this temporal aspect may be here, but I don't think that it's primary. What is primary is the sense of preeminence. Okay, so Psalm 89 is an important psalm. You might want to turn to that. This is a really important passage. And we were here several weeks ago. But Psalm 89, we find a good definition of firstborn. And so this is Psalm 89, verse 27. It's speaking of David and, of course, the Messianic Davidic king. And Psalm 89, verse 27 says, I will make him the firstborn. What's the firstborn? The highest of the kings of the earth. So here it's a status. It's about being preeminent. It's about hierarchy. It's about authority. Now, who is being discussed? Well, David is mentioned by name in verse 20. So was David the firstborn? No, he wasn't. There's that comical story, right, where all of David's brothers are lined up, right? The king is going to be selected, and David's out with the sheep. And Samuel goes through all of the candidates, and he says no to all of them. Don't you have anybody else? And, well, there's that shepherd, you know, but he's out with the sheep. And Samuel says, none of you are sitting down till he comes back. So David is not the firstborn, but here he's called the firstborn. So this is an atemporal sense, and it carries the meaning of authority and hierarchy. So firstborn, by the way, this verse, Colossians 1:15, was part of the source of the 4th century heresy called Arianism, where Christ is a created being. And quite honestly, that's a really good example of how much trouble you can get into when you're interpreting the Bible with complete disregard for the immediate context as well as its Old Testament context. There's really no excuse for such a careless interpretation. So, how is Christ the firstborn in New Testament theology? I have a couple of ways for you. He is the first to be resurrected. So when we get to the new creation theme, there is that temporal aspect that is in view. Time zero of the new creation starts with the resurrection. Okay? We worship him, so there's that sense of preeminence. The church is identified with him. This is a really neat passage, so I'll read it to you. Hebrews 12:22-23. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. So the assembly of the firstborn, the church is identified with Christ. And then, of course, we are to be conformed with him, and we've read Romans 8:29 already. I do want to mention in passing that if you read commentaries on our passage this morning, you'll probably see something about wisdom literature, and I just want to mention this to be comprehensive. The general idea is that the biblical authors, like Proverbs 8 and Psalm 104, they look at the created world and they say, God must be really, really wise. And so they start associating wisdom with creation. Now, what happens is that this develops in Second Temple literature, like the wisdom of Solomon and the wisdom of Ben Sira and Philo. And so this develops until wisdom is almost like a personified being. And so a lot of scholars will say, well, that's part of the background here. And I simply don't see that at all. And I don't know how scholars get to that point other than reading this into 1 Corinthians 8 and then saying, well, you have image of God in 1 Corinthians 8:6, and so, well, we must have the wisdom literature background here and our hymn this morning as well. And I simply don't agree with that. I don't have a problem with it methodologically. The biblical authors often draw on contemporary ideas to convey what they want to say. That's not a problem. I just don't see wisdom here as being influential in Paul's Christology. The only reason it seems to be influential is that both Paul and this wisdom literature are ultimately drawing from creation, and so naturally they have some parallels, but I don't think that there are any real parallels here. And when you look at what the wisdom literature background gives you, there's nothing that you can't get from the Genesis background anyway. So I just want to mention that in passing. Let's move on to verse 16 then. Keep the 4th century heresy that I mentioned in mind as you read this verse. Remember that the heresy is Christ is a created being, okay? So, for by him all things were created, or in him, I prefer that translation, for in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. So it's difficult to see how Paul could be any more clear on this point. So it's likely that the passive for all things were created is a passive that goes back to Christ. So all things were created through Christ. And that's because of this important preposition, in him, which I think, yes, in him. So increasingly scholars have noted the nuance of this preposition is one of sphere. So all things are created in him, in Christ, that is in the sphere of Christ. And practically that means that all created, all creation is within the control of Christ and none of it is independent from him. So does that make sense? If you think about a sphere and imagine all of creation in it, that's kind of the sense of this preposition. So that supports reading this passive, were created as were created by Christ, that all things were created in the sphere of Christ and that nothing in the created realm is independent of him. Paul mentions four things, the thrones, dominions, rulers, and authorities. I'll just mention these briefly, and I think that the first two are primarily heavenly powers, and the second two are primarily earthly. And we could go into a lot of detail and ask what these individual concepts refer to, but I think it's more important at this point to notice the flow of Paul's argument, because now he's signaling where he's going with all this. In chapter 2, he's going to bring up one of these terms again and say that Christ defeated these powers. And so you can see then, okay, Paul's starting to establish, okay, we have Christ, and then we have these other authorities. Some of them are earthly, some of them are heavenly, but there's a difference. There's a distinction. And so Paul is telegraphing to his readers where he's eventually heading with his theology. Do you think prepositions are boring? I disagree. All things were created in Christ, through Christ, and for Christ. We're going to come back to these prepositions. Paul uses the same prepositions in the same order in the second part of our hymn, which furthers this balanced the hymn is in these two parts with the new creation and the creation themes. So what does it mean then for Christ to be the goal of creation? And so I'll just read Philippians 2, 9 through 11, which expresses this nicely. Therefore God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father. And so this will be done by all creation. All creation will reach this point of confessing Jesus as Lord. And finally, for your own consideration, you may want to look at the parallels. We won't read them because of time, but you do have this in your email if you'd like to consider these striking parallels between the language of 1 Corinthians 8:6 and the verse Colossians 1:16. So this is some fairly in-depth theology, isn't it? Don't worry, I've been lost for at least the last 10 minutes. So if you're struggling, there's no problem. Colossians 1:17 then, and he is before all things. So this goes back to what I was describing earlier. Paul is very inclusive with his language. And so when we want to say before, what does he mean Christ is before all things? Does that mean Christ is over all things? Does that mean he's above all things? And the answer is yes. So Christ is before all things in all senses of the word before. Whatever before means, he is all of that. Is Christ above all things? Yes, in all senses of the word. You see, so it's very inclusive. And so I get a little bit, I kind of distance myself from commentators at these points where they're trying to very precisely nuance this language, because it's clear that Paul's making a comprehensive, inclusive case. And in him all things hold together. This is referring to the sustaining power of Christ. Hebrews 1:3, he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. So there's that sustaining language once again. So Paul gives us a short verse to balance the theology that he has so far put us through. Remember that our creation, new creation theme transitions at verse 18. So the creation theme is verses 15 through 17, and as we enter verse 18, we enter the theme of new creation. He is the head of the body, the church. So notice what Paul's doing, right? Who is supreme over creation? Well, the Son. Okay, so who is supreme over new creation? Well, the Son. All right, so you see Paul is setting up this parallel. And there is some debate over the head here. What does it mean that he is the head of the body? Does this mean authority? Does it mean that he is the source from which the body grows and so forth? And you can anticipate my response here. Yes, is the answer. Okay, it's all of these. Paul is being very inclusive with his treatment of these issues. There's also, very importantly, the nuance of unity. So listen closely to Ephesians 4, 15 through 16. The head of the church is associated with the concept of unity. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. So clearly, there is the concept of unity associated with Christ, the head of the body. He is the beginning. The beginning of what? Right, we're a new creation now. So this can cause some confusion. For example, when you read Revelation 3:14, that says Christ is the beginning of God's creation. That can really be confusing if you don't keep track of the creation, new creation motif. Which creation is being talked about in Revelation 3:14? Well, that would be new creation. And that's clear from the context and from the overall flow of Revelation itself. And so he is the beginning of new creation and the firstborn from the dead, just as Christ is both chronologically prior and hierarchically over creation, he is also chronologically prior and hierarchically over new creation, over the body. So we've been building up to this, and we can get through this now. We want to ask the question, what is the theological relationship between the eternal divine archetype, the Son, the image of God, and the resurrected, exalted Christ? How do we express that theologically? And so this seems like a mouthful, but we've already put the pieces together, and so this gives us the big picture. Greg Beale says, the eschatological image of Christ in his resurrected estate is the manifestation of his eternal ontic status as the divine archetypal image and its eschatological significance in light of Christ's incarnation, death, and resurrection. There's a quiz on this question after the meeting's over, and you can't leave until you answer it. So think about what he's saying, the eternal ontic status. So let's start there. So there is ontological continuity between the eternal divine archetype and the resurrected Christ. So what that means, for example, is that the Son did not come into existence during the incarnation, nor did the Son cease to be the image of God during the incarnation. Okay, so there's ontological continuity. But clearly there's something different with the resurrected Christ and the eternal divine archetype that Paul brings up at the first part of this hymn. And so how do we express this continuity in theological terms? And what Beale is saying as he's kind of packaging up this theology that Paul gives us is that the eschatological Christ, the resurrected and exalted Christ, is the eternal divine archetype with the added significance of the incarnation. So you put the eternal divine archetype, that concept, added to the significance of the incarnation, and that gives you the theological understanding of who the eschatological Christ is. So what is that significance? Well, the significance of the incarnation, the significance of the atonement, it's multifaceted. There's the revelatory significance. The image of God has a revelatory function. There's a redemptive significance. This is what Lauren talked about a couple of weeks ago and what we will revisit at the end of verse 20. And so you can continue to nuance what that significance is. But the important part to remember here is the ontological continuity and then the eschatological Christ being the eternal divine archetype with that added theological significance of the incarnation and the atonement. So it adds a lot of our understanding of God's revelation, God's redemption, to our theology of Christ. So, let's move on to verse 19. We have here the prepositions that I told you were not boring. All things were created in Christ, through Christ, and for Christ. And then in the second half of the hymn, Paul says, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, through him to reconcile for himself all things. So there's some literary artistry going on here as well. I want to move now to our temple theme. And we won't spend too much time on this, as time is running out, but Psalm 68:16 through 17. I'll read this for you. Why do you look with hatred, O many-peaked mountain, at the mountain that God desired for his abode? Yes, where the Lord will dwell forever. The chariots of God are twice 10,000. Thousands upon thousands, the Lord is among them. Sinai is now in the sanctuary. And so the translation is a bit different here, but what you can do is something similar to what we did a couple of weeks ago when we looked at the terms ekklesia and we looked at the terms hagioi. So we looked at church and holy ones, where do these intersect? And we saw that they intersect in Psalm 89. Well, if you look at well-pleased and dwell, which Paul uses here, and you say, where do they intersect in the Old Testament? The answer is Psalm 68. And so Psalm 16 through 17 can be translated, God was well-pleased to dwell in Zion, the temple. The Lord will dwell there forever. Sinai is now the sanctuary. And so the point is that Paul wants us to think of Jesus in terms of the divine presence that's mentioned in Psalm 68. So this is our temple theme. Regarding the fullness of God, you heard this morning already from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1, the song of verse 2 or 3, the song of the seraphim, the whole earth is full of God's glory. And Psalm 72:19 reads, blessed be his glorious name forever, may the whole earth be filled with his glory. And so when you think of the fullness of God, this is something that commentators will typically say, well, look, there's Gnosticism. There's absolutely no reason to posit Gnosticism as an explanation when you get the same theology from the Old Testament, which is exactly where Paul's drawing from in the first place. So together these two things, God's dwelling on earth and the fullness of the gospel, recall what Paul says in verses 5 and 6, the gospel is going forth throughout the whole earth, it's bearing fruit and increasing. These two concepts provide the background for verse 19. In 1:20, Jesus is the goal of creation. We've discussed some of this, and as our time is winding down, I'll just say that this was the topic of Lauren's message a couple of weeks ago, so we won't repeat this, but keep in mind the revelatory significance of the image. So let me just read verse 20. And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. And so when you keep the revelatory significance of the image in mind, then what we can say is that Christ, that God reveals himself through creation, but that more importantly, he reveals himself through redemption. And so this is the revelatory aspect of the eternal Son given to us in the redemption, making peace by the blood of his cross. So we get to our application then. And so there are beliefs that require action and beliefs that do not require action. If I believe that it's going to rain on the other side of the world tomorrow, that belief does not require any action on my part. But if I'm standing in a parking lot and there's a car coming at me at 100 miles an hour and I believe that car is going to hit me, then that belief requires action. I need to move, right? So the belief that Christ is preeminent requires action. If we do not put this belief into practice, then it's still true, but it's worthless to us personally, right? And so how do we put Christ preeminent? Well, we can start by asking some questions, and you can just fill in the blank. Is Christ preeminent in our finances, in our families, in our worries, in our ethics, in our morality? Is Christ preeminent in our thoughts, and so forth? And we can extend this to current events and say, is Christ preeminent in our state and in our national affairs? And so if we were in California or we were in New York City and religious places, religious gatherings were being targeted, how would we respond to that? Because the overall picture is that if history is any indication of the future of this country, then the church is going to be under a lot more pressure to shut down later on than it currently is in this pandemic. And so do we have the courage then to say that Christ is preeminent and to act on that belief? And so how do we act on that belief? What's the most basic way? What's step one? And step one, I would say, would simply be the title of our message this morning, and that is focus on Christ. So that's step one, to actually putting that belief into action. For our closing prayer, I'll just read these couple of verses, and then we'll conclude. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Thank you for your kind attention.